evening and welcome back, everyone. Round three, final installment.
Wait.
It's all fixed after this.
Do the people that were here all three get gold stars or something?
Gold star. You get even better. You get Shalabayas.
We get a certificate.
You get a certificate. You hereby have Shalabayas. We should put like certificates up in people's homes that you are clear. You have Shalabayas. All right. So, Hever, we're down to three final principles. Of John Gottman's seven principles, and really, I think probably more Torah also to discuss tonight than any of the previous nights. Before we even get going with that, I want to give an introduction really for the next two principles. This is principle five and principle six. Principles five and six are really corollaries of one another, and they deal with problems. They deal with problems, difficulties, I don't know if I want to go so far as to say strife, but things that come up over the course of our interactions with our spouses that, you know, we would label as less than smooth. I want A and she wants B, and I want to go in one direction, she wants something else, I want to do something, and that's just not met with immediate acceptance, let's say. So, a brief introduction about the nature of solvable versus unsolvable problems, and then we'll get into something of a definition, or something of a means of actually recognizing what kind of problem am I up against. Is this something solvable or unsolvable? First and foremost, just the reality and the knowledge that there are two different types of problems out there is worth taking stock of and worth wrapping our heads around, I think, in the following context. I think that this often learned Mishnah in Avos is very, very helpful here. This is really a statement of Rabbi Tarfon. The actual expression in the Mishnah is, Hu Haya Omer, Pirkei Avos, Perek Beis, Mishnah Tezayin. Lo Alecha Hamalacha Ligmor. Anything they turn into a song, you know, is going to be well remembered. Lo Alecha Hamalacha Ligmor. So the work, the labor is not upon you to complete. V'lo Ata Ben Chorin Libatel Mimena. Nor are you a Ben Chorin. Are you just completely free to be Batel, to remain idle from actually working on it? Both are simultaneously true. On the one hand, it is a massive avoda that you therefore do not need to complete, on the one hand. On the other hand, the fact that I'll never complete it doesn't give me the right to say that therefore I just don't need to do it. What are we talking about here? We're talking about learning Torah. We're talking about Avodas Hashem. We're taking note of the fact that it is impossible to be an absolutely perfect 100% Eved Hashem. We're going to make mistakes. It's impossible to learn all of Torah. We speak about, he knows Kol HaTorah Kula. No, he doesn't. I don't care who the name is. No, he doesn't. No, he doesn't. Because Kol HaTorah Kula is infinite. So it is impossible to know, really, Kol HaTorah Kula. We use it as in colloquial terms to mean that he knows Shas Kol, and knows Shulchan Aruch Kol, and knows Nosei Kelim Kol. But it is impossible to learn and to know everything, because there's always more. As soon as you uncover one parish, there are 14 more waiting in the wings. It's impossible. And I think that ultimately what this gives us as a mode for life is to, on the one hand, be ambitious, and yet, at the same time, be reasonable. We cannot allow the enormity of the work and the enormity of the difficulties that we're going to face to allow us to just say, so forget it, so I can't complete it all, and I can't accomplish it all, I can't do it all, so why should I even bother? And it creates a sense of yayosh, that I may as well just give up. Why should I bother forging ahead when I know that it's impossible to make things perfect? It's impossible to get 100 on this test. And yet, I still need to maintain that degree of ambition. But even as I maintain that ambition, and I'm still going to forge ahead, and I'm still going to do, and I'm going to try my hardest, to recognize that we will never get 100 on the test. It's never going to be perfect. And living within that ability to sort of modulate between the two and recognize that both are simultaneously true, aside from creating people and creating individuals that will be productive, that will be ambitious, that will accomplish a lot, is also what's going to keep us happy and grounded. So let's take that premise and we'll try to apply it as we think about some of the problems that we might encounter and some of the less than rosy interactions that are naturally, as a matter of course, going to come up over the course of our relationships with our spouses. So, sort of two different ways of thinking about the distinction between solvable problems and unsolvable problems. A distinction is, are these problems situational or are they perpetual? Do they only come up in sort of isolated scenarios, isolated situations, Or are these the kinds of things that I find that we are arguing, and we're disagreeing, we're not arguing, that we're disagreeing about these things again and again and again and again. And it just comes up in a multitude of different ways. It's not just that I get annoyed about the fact that you didn't remember to make the phone call to the water company. It's that it's the water company, and it's the doctor's appointments, and it's the kids' lunches, and it's like every time I ever ask you to do anything, like it just never happens, and you never actually seize it, and you never actually do it. So is this something that you find is sort of cropping up in a variety and multitude of different ways, or is it just something that's isolated for whatever reason I can't get or we can't get our collective act together, I can't fulfill your needs or fulfill what you're labeling as being my responsibilities in this one particular light, or does it come up again and again and again? Is it logistic, or is it more deeply symbolic? Meaning to say, do you find, or do I find, that I'm exhibiting this behavior that you find really annoying and is creating some strife and some bit of chafing in our marriage? Do we find that this is really just a function of, listen, it's because I had a lot on my plate and it was this particular day and I sort of needed to do this because it was the means to an end in order to get something else done? Or is there something deeper going on? Meaning, let's go back to the case of calling or not calling the water company. Right? Is it that, taking care of bills or not taking care of bills? Right? Is it that this is just logistic? Finding the time to be, when do I have time to make phone calls? I have time to make phone calls really only when I'm in the car. And for me to make that kind of phone call while I'm in the car, while I need to have those papers in front of me, I had a Rebbe who used to make it a, it was like as a matter of course, would go through his mail in the car. It was frightening. It's absolutely frightening. But this is like one of those only in Israel, hopefully an only in Israel. So he would like have it on the table. It was like you'd walk out the door, we'd see it if we like stayed over to set. Take it, he'd have it on the passenger seat next to him, and like as he goes, stops and he'd go through. It was absolutely frightening. But nevertheless, I can't take care of these things because this is the only time that I have. Or is it symbolic? Meaning, is there something that perhaps is more deeply embedded that I have a very difficult time just dealing with bills because it was of the way that my father always dealt with them or my mother always dealt with them, and I can't bring myself to do it in the same sort of way, or this was always a matter of tension in my house and I don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole and I sort of need to outsource it or I need to just have nothing to do with it. Understanding which one of those categories these problems fit into can really go a long way in helping us, not even necessarily solving the problem, some of them are just going to be unsolvable, but at least being able to recognize that they're just part of life, being able to wrap our heads around it and being able to just cope with them and allow them to sort of continue to exist in our marriage, but still be able to move along happily enough. So just as an example, right, take a case of literally driving me crazy. This is a case that Gottman actually speaks about in two different capacities. He dealt with two different couples. I think in both instances, it was the wife complaining about the husband's driving, which I think is, again, I don't chas v'shalom. I would never dream of being, you know, so stereotypical. But come on. I think that is overwhelmingly, if that complaint is being made, that's probably the direction that it's going in. At any rate, so two different scenarios, both the exact same complaint. You're driving recklessly, you're speeding, and it drives me crazy, and I get nervous, and I don't like being in the car with you. In one instance, it came up situationally. It wasn't perpetual. It's not that every time they went out, they found that they were always arguing about this, and it didn't matter if it was rush hour, it didn't matter what time of day it was. It was specifically in the morning. And whenever they would talk about it, and they were getting into some measure of gridlock, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, but whenever they would talk about it, what would end up happening was, well, I need to drive quickly because I must be at work on time. And because we're commuting together and we never leave the house on time, because you always take longer than I do to actually get yourself together and get out the door and get out of the house, that's why I drive crazy. I'm not like married to driving crazy or to speeding. I'd be more than happy to stop, but that means that you're going to need to do your part in making sure that you get out the door. Now, without even having that conversation, you can probably imagine, right, that that conversation never happened until they were actually sitting in the office or the love lab of Dr. John Gottman. I think we could probably, if we racked our brains, we could come up with lots of these sorts of conversations that we've likely had, sometimes even happening again and again and again, where we probably just never thought to ask, what's this about? What's going on? Why are you doing this? Maybe it is an imminently solvable problem, but we just assume otherwise. Compare and contrast that to another case that Gottman had, where it was just reckless driving in every capacity imaginable. It didn't matter if the couple was running late or if they were on time. He just liked owning the road, and it seemed like the more frightened she was, the more that he enjoyed it. What was going on? I don't know. You know, they dug deeper and at some point realized that it was a matter of his being able to maintain his independence, and you're not going to tell me what to do, and my parents aren't going to tell me what to do. Your parents have been dead for 40 years. They're not telling you what to do anywhere. They're still not going to... They still want me to drive slowly. And it was just embedded very, very deeply in his consciousness and his psyche, and it was a lot to sort of uncover. But it was at least, or they were able to get to a point where they recognized that this is something that was either right there on the surface, where maybe just the changing of a little bit of a morning routine, waking up 5 minutes earlier, could potentially completely disarm and neutralize an entire argument or debate that they would otherwise be having forever, as opposed to something that frankly just might be what it is, but knowing where it comes from can still be very, very helpful in being able to wrap your arms around it, appreciate it, understand that it's not just completely reckless, but that it's coming from a much deeper sort of place. So having discussed some of that background, let's dive in. Let's talk about principle number five. Principle number five in Gottman's eyes is solve your solvable problems. And he gives a number of steps to do so. Having mentioned a little bit what a solvable problem potentially looks like, let's also remember that just because it's solvable doesn't mean that we're actually spending the time solving it. Just because it's solvable doesn't mean that we're necessarily spending the time even recognizing that it's a solvable problem. How do we actually get there? So this is very important. He says step number one in ever having these conversations, and we know usually when they're about to happen, it's going to be a conversation that isn't necessarily pleasant. We're going to be discussing something that we know is a matter of debate within the couple, within our relationship. He says you have to soften your startup. Divrei Chacham benachas nishmaim. Pasuk in Koheles, Mizaakas Moshel Bakasilim. The first part of the pasuk is often quoted, Divrei Chachamim Benachas Nishmaim, that the words of the Chacham, the words of the wise, are heard when they are Benachas, when they're spoken softly. Nobody likes being yelled at. Nobody likes being criticized. And typically, whether we will admit to it or not, we will throw every possible defense mechanism the way of whoever it is who's screaming at us and yelling at us as a means of deflecting all of that really harsh, really nasty criticism. As opposed to a much more softened sort of startup where, you know, I was thinking and I just wanted to let you know how it made, and this is a lot of it, how it made me feel and my reaction to it and the way that I'm seeing it and making it more personal about this was my response and my reaction and how it makes me feel as opposed to it's all on you and you're just an objectively terrible person and terrible human being and this is just an argument or a statement about your quality of character. So I think the end of the pasuk is also worthwhile. Mizaakas Moshel Bakasilim. More so than the yelling and screaming, than the shouting of a Moshel Bakasilim, one who rules over a bunch of fools. One who rules over a bunch of fools. Sometimes we can even turn the other person into a fool by treating them that way and by acting that way. I spoke about this a little bit last time. That sort of if you beat your partner into submission, so that's great, I won the argument, and they lost the argument. But if they lost the argument and they keep on losing arguments, and every time you have an argument, they always lose, so I might feel triumphant in the moment, but ultimately what it means is that I'm married to a loser. And that really doesn't sit well with us in the long term. The idea of just being able to batter somebody into submission might work in the short term, but what it means is that I've turned everybody else into people, or whoever it is that I'm conversing with, into somebody who's just a seal. They're a fool who has no opinion because I never validate their opinion and I never hearken their opinion, never listen to their opinion, never listen to anything they're saying because I'm too busy yelling and screaming and telling them how wrong they are to ever get to the point of actually appreciating and understanding their perspective. We don't want to be in that position. Nobody wants to end up saying, great, I'm a Moshe, I'm a ruler, I'm king, and I'm the master of the house. That's great, but you've turned everybody else around you into a ksil who's frightened to even formulate or ever share their own opinion. So, Divrei Chachamim, Benachas Nishmam, Teddy Roosevelt also knew so very, very well. He carried a big stick. Still, you speak softly, and hopefully that goes a very, very long way in just diffusing that argument before it even starts. You're preventing your partner from feeling the need to throw every possible excuse and rationalization your way as just a means of supporting and reasserting their own ego. Step number two, says Gottman, learn to make and receive repair attempts. Something that we certainly talk about around the Yom Menorah is that when we quote, at least at the very beginning, but it runs the way through the entire Pasuk, is that when we think about the formula for tshuva, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us this like incantation that we can recite. And we do it again and again and again and again and again, all throughout the Yom Noraim, Hashem, Hashem, Kel Rachum V'chanun, and they're His words. They're Hashem's words that He says to Moshe Rabbeinu, say these words and all will be forgiven. The Gemara in Shabbos seems to suggest, about even the tshuva process itself, that it doesn't appear to be enough to just say these words. To just say that Hashem is merciful, that's only half the battle. But that what we're meant to do, says Abba Shaul Omer, Va'anveyu, he's quoting the Pasuk of Zekeli Va'anveyu, that this is my God and I'm going to glorify Him. How do I glorify Him? Havedomela. I glorify Him by saying that He's my role model. I glorify Him by saying that I look up to Him, that I want to be just like Him. Mahu chanun v'rachum, af atah hayach chanun v'rachum. Just as He's merciful, He's gracious, you want to follow in the exact same footsteps. And what it means is that if I recognize that I require HaKadosh Baruch Hu's mercy just to be able to survive, then how could I not make an effort to adopt those exact same midos myself? If I am forced, if I need Hashem's rachmanis, if I need Hashem's chaninos to be able to survive, to be able to perpetuate that relationship with Him, then how can I be, it's totally hypocritical of me to not offer the exact same to all those around me. So now, when it comes to our relationship with Hashem, Hashem Himself never really needs our rachmanis, right? It's that, Hashem, I recognize that I need your rachman, I need you to be merciful towards me. How dare I not turn to the person next to me who's seeking my forgiveness? Can you imagine, right? Erev Yom Kippur, somebody finally made that very, very difficult phone call. It's been 10 years we haven't spoken. They pick up the phone and they make the call. So I want you to know that I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry, and I hope that we can patch things together. It's Erev Yom Kippur. I don't want to go into Yom Kippur like this, and I hope that this coming year we can like work things out and we can make it better. And I say, who do you think you are? And I get off the phone, and you know, it's been too long, I forget about you, and I don't need it. And then the next day, I'm like clapping al-chayt. Are you kidding me? So you're asking Hashem to take you back after all that time, but I refused to give the same to the person who was requesting the same of me. Now, in our relationship with Hashem, it's one directional. I need Hashem's mercy, therefore I should give to somebody else. In our relationship with our spouses, or really our relationships with anyone, it works in both directions constantly. If I'm not willing to be merciful, if I'm not willing to give the benefit of the doubt, then do I have any rights to actually demand it or request it or ask for it in another capacity? We all need it. A little bit of humility dictates that we all need it. We're all going to mess up at some point. We're all going to need our spouse to overlook some glaring error, like when I didn't pay the phone bill from the car, but it's not because I couldn't, it was because I was like reading a magazine while I was driving, not because I refused to look at the medical bill while I'm driving. Or I completely forgot about our kids. Oh, it happened. We're both guilty of that. It happened last year. Yeah. So we're all in need. We're all in need of mercy, so much for our own children. We're all in need of mercy, so therefore we need to be open enough to be able to give it as well. What Gottman speaks about as being repair attempts, and this is where humor is so critical, and it's so important, it's so worthwhile. It can mean being in the middle of a heated argument. He says he sees this all the time. You're in the middle of a heated argument, and one, right, either husband or wife, will just like make like a silly face. Like, you stink. And it's like silly, and it's lighthearted. And it is really an attempt deep down to just sort of neutralize things, just chill things out. It keeps on ratcheting up, and it's getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. Just doing something that's a little silly and it's a little friendly, or saying like, you know, oh boy, wow, we haven't had a fight like this in a while. Don't change it! And just being able to say, I get it. You're making a bid, effectively, for a little bit more space. You're trying to calm things down. You're trying to cool it down a little bit. And being willing to actually accept it. And if we're willing to accept it, also be willing to sort of make some of them on our own. And if when we make them, we want them to be accepted, again, it's cyclical. Being willing to accept it when we find that our spouse is trying to do the same. Step three, he says, soothe yourself and each other. This is there is a particularly important point, I think, for from couples here. But the pasuk in Kohelet, the kol zman ve'es l'chol chefetz tachas hashamayim. So everything has a time, and everything has a season. Eis l'achashos ve'es l'daber. There's a time for silence, there's a time to talk. Picking your spots, and picking your moments, and knowing what it is to, when it is appropriate to keep the conversation going, and knowing when it's appropriate to maybe just keep quiet. We spoke about last week, talking about how the importance of like calling a timeout. That maybe right now, when we both just walked in the door, one of us walked in the door, we both have so much on our minds that we want to talk about, we want to share. I want to process my day, you want to process your day. I want to tell you about all the nasty things that happened to me and unload and tell you all the worst lashon hara about all those people that I spoke to today, and you want to do the exact same thing. And maybe right now is not necessarily the best time for either one of us to do it. Maybe we should sit down. Maybe we should have dinner first. Maybe we should get some food in our bellies. Maybe we should just relax. Maybe there's too much noise going on in the house in general. Maybe we just need to ask for a timeout. What Gottman's talking about is really a timeout amid arguments, which can be a little bit more, you need to be a little bit more adept. You need to be a little bit more like emotionally, socially dexterous to be able to pull this off. But sometimes saying like, you know, I don't know if we're really getting anywhere right now. This is really important to both of us. We're both feeling really... We're just both crazed about this. Maybe let's just calm down and maybe let's just call it quits for now. Let's pick this up again in 20 minutes. And again, in part, it is learning to receive. That's not exactly a repair attempt, but it's learning to receive that when the request is actually being made. Oh, no, you don't. Don't you walk away from me. I'm going to let you have it. And just say, fine. You want 10 minutes? Fine. Let's come back to this in 10. Let's come back to this in an hour. And being able to then calm yourself. Gottman goes on about, like, make sure you're sitting in comfortable chairs when this is going on. Make sure that, like the lighting is right. Make sure that, he doesn't talk about this, but I think, make sure that you're well-fed. I gave a drush about being hangry a while ago, right? Esav, about Esav being hangry. Esav was in the, he was at his absolute lowest when he comes home and he's exhausted and he's hungry. And what does he do? He sells the bechor. How many times have we just, like, sold the bechorah away because we just needed to have a decent meal, we just needed to relax a little bit. So picking our spots and knowing when it's an appropriate time to relax and not. There's something that Gottman mentioned slightly, but I think it's just so worth harping upon for firm couples. If you know that this is a conversation that needs to be had, it's not always easy managing this because sometimes it just happens in the moment. Right, it is reactive to whatever it is that just happened 10 minutes ago. You always act like this. You were driving crazy. No, I wasn't. How dare you? It's because we were running late. You took too long. You were getting dressed. Blah, blah, blah. And sometimes it just happens in the moment. First of all, realizing that we can actually shelf these things and we can table these things for another time. We tend to do this same shtick in our chinuch, and it's not true there either. I have to correct this behavior right now. Because if I don't correct this behavior right now, they're going to sail clear off the derech. So I better make sure that I start yelling at them right this moment, because if we come back to it tomorrow when, like, I'm more level-headed, then, like, the opportunity is lost. We can more often than not table conversations and pick them up later. If that is the case, and we're instead bringing up something, not that's necessarily happening in real time, but if we're bringing something up that really could be discussed anytime, could even be discussed in a week from now, there is a lot to be said for not having these difficult conversations while the wife is anida, and while it becomes difficult to physically calm one another and physically soothe one another. A holding of hands and a hug goes a very, very long way, and being able to convey that, like this is okay, this isn't breaking us, we still love each other, all is good, we have a firm relationship, and that's much more difficult if all you have are your words. And your words are being used to have a conversation about what is wrong. It's very difficult to simultaneously talk about how, but you know what, everything is really still fine and everything is okay. But a lot of that can be conveyed with physical touch that isn't feasible during half the month, oftentimes. So it's worth picking our spots, not only mid-conversation and mid-argument, but also when these conversations really ought to be taking place and happening in the first place. Step four, critical, very important, compromise. So this is, I think, worth talking about with respect to Shalom Bayis and the idea of building a home and a Binyan HaBayis in the first place. The Tur and Yeridei quotes two different opinions. We all know about this. But it's worth, you can't go through like a series on Shalom Bayis without talking about this. We all know about this. The Tur quotes two different deos, two different opinions. That's the way that the mezuzah ought to face. Pirish Rashi, Tzricha Leo Zekufa, that the mezuzah has to be straight up. Arka, it's orech, it's height, should be la'orech mezuzah ha'pesach. It should be aligned with the height of the actual door frame. Then there's Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, Piresha Psula Bezkiva. You can't have it sticking straight up. El Tzarech LaHashkiva, you have to lay it down. The mezuzah has to be flat. Arka, its height, L'Rochav Mezuzah HaPesach. It has to be along the breadth, along the width. So Rashi says it has to go straight up. Rabbeinu Tam says that it has to be flat. What do we actually do? We do both. We do both. So we angle it. We angle the mezuzah. So you'd say that makes a lot of sense, right? Every machlokas should work this way. No machlokas works this way. We never do this. We never do this. Never do this. It is very rare that Shulchan Aruch talks about, we're doing this now, Shulchan Aruch talks about Rashi tefillin or Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. For the Yarei Shemayim, you try to put on both and you try to be Yotzei L'chol Hadeyos. It's very unusual. It's not unusual to say that I want to be Yotze according to everybody. It's very odd that we come up with a hybrid solution where we do something that's not really good enough according to either. Right? To go out of our way and to do it this way and to also do that way. Just came across Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was known to count Sviras HaOmer twice. He would count Omer the whole way through saying Ba-Omer, and then he would count Svira the whole way through saying La-Omer. What we do for mezuzah is basically saying blah omer. It's neither. Blah omer doesn't count for any. What is that? That's all. It's like the Ramad. It's like everybody wins. Nobody wins. So they say a vart. I don't know who says it. Everybody says it. I think it's so beautiful that it's specifically when it comes to the bias. Specifically when it comes to the bias. That when it comes to the bias, we have to be able and willing to readily make compromises. To recognize that it's only win. Not if everybody wins, but really only if nobody wins. But everybody's happy that nobody won. That I don't need to say that, no, it's my opinion, and absolutely it's going to be maintained. It's your opinion, it's absolutely it's going to be maintained. But that here specifically we make a point of coming up with a hybrid that everybody can live with. I can live with it being not exactly 100%, 180 degrees. I can live with it not exactly being 90 degrees. We had cut up a 45 degree angle, and like Shalom Al Yisrael, and will survive. The importance of compromising. Sometimes we believe, we'll get to this a little bit later, but sometimes we believe that I don't have the right to compromise, because if I compromise, I'm giving up what I believe in and everything that I am, my mahus and my essence, and I can't. And we need to be willing to say that that's just not the case, and that if I genuinely love my spouse and believe that their opinion is valid, then I should have the ability to recognize and incorporate whatever bit of their opinion along with my own to create something of a hybrid that we can all abide by, we could all live by. Step five. This is, I think, the first time that I violate copyright infringement, which is pretty good, three classes in. So Gottman says, process grievances so they don't linger. Make sure that we're not just like, okay, yeah, fine. Okay, no, we're good. We're good. That's fine. Everything's fine. Everything's okay. Everything's okay, and I will just act towards you in the most passive-aggressive of ways for the rest of our lives. So it's a pasuk, mikra malehu, lo sisna sachicha bilvadecha, that you can't begrudge, you cannot hate your neighbor, your brother, your friend in your heart. Hocheach tochiach hasamisacha, you have to rebuke your friend. The Ramban says that it's a continuation, that it's a process, that they play off of one another. The Omer HaKosav al sisna sachicha bilvadecha, the Ramban says that it says that you can't hate your friend in your heart, ba'asoso lecha shelo kirtzoncha, when he did something towards you in a way that you didn't like, you didn't appreciate. So what should you do? The pasuk is giving you the recipe. Aval tochicho, you should rebuke him. Madua kacha asisa imadi. Why did you do this? If I don't have that conversation, I have to be an enormous tzaddik to not walk around with the feeling of animosity and resentment towards the other, maybe even forever. And it just lingers. And it's silly for it to linger. Have the conversation. Say, you know, and pick the time. Pick the time, and when the mood is right, and when there's the opportunity to soothe one another and to be calm yourself, pick the time to be able to have a conversation. But there's no sense in allowing this. And indeed, it may be usher, maybe an isser the oraisa, to allow this to just build up in a capacity that leaves me with ill will towards, of all people, towards my spouse, for who knows how long, while I still harbor this degree of resentment. So, chazara, soften your startup. Learn to make and receive repair attempts. Soothe yourself and each other. Learn to compromise with one another. It's only a win, really, if nobody wins, even in areas that we wouldn't necessarily see halacha operate according to this method here when it comes to building a home. Indeed, we do. And finally, process grievances. Don't just allow them to build up and effectively be the ruin of the relationship, even though they really could have been solved when they were still yet embryonic. Okay. Moving on, and principle number six again. Yeah?
What are unsolvable problems?
There are none. So let's talk about unsolvable problems. Unsolvable problems, we're going to get to it. This is like really the corollary to it. So principle six is overcoming gridlock. Gridlock is what Gottman talks about, those problems, and really this can be divided into two different categories. There are problems that are fundamentally and inherently unsolvable. And I don't even know if we should use the word problem, but we will. Meaning that from my perspective, it's a problem. That my spouse is away, that he or she will just always be. It's not changing. There's nothing that I can say. There's nothing that I can do. No amount of having a conversation or having conversations is going to fundamentally change who my spouse is. And that's going to be rough, right? This is the difficult reality in the best of relationships, in the best and the healthiest and most loving of marriages. This is the issue. Here's the rub. You take two people and you try to get them to share a life together, and these are the kinds of things that happen. It's not going to be all wine and roses. There are going to be things that just irk me about your personality for the rest of my life, and there are going to be things that irk me, you, about my personality for the rest of your life. And that's just how it is. That's one brand of gridlock, where there's just it's an impasse. On the one hand. On the other hand, there are things that become unsolvable just because it's like, you know, the money in the bank has been compounding for so long that it's actually become its own asset, right? But negatively so. That it's just this problem that continues to grow and grow and grow, and we never dealt with it correctly. And it was a solvable problem, again, when it was in its embryonic state, when it was small, and we could have dealt with it, and we could have had a conversation about it, and we didn't. So what happens? It just continues to, it's the snowball. It continues to roll downhill until it's massive, and then we just can't move it. So four steps to recognizing what we're actually talking about in the first place. How do you know? How do you know what it is? How do you know if we're at an impasse? How do you know if this is something that is easier and more solvable or not necessarily? So number one is that it's cyclical. It's just that it's the same argument again and again and again. We keep having this. We keep arguing about this, and there doesn't seem to be any resolution. Meaning that husband and wife were arguing about his driving. It wasn't as simple as, one second, when does this happen? When does this come up? I can recognize that it happens every day on the way to work, and it never happens on the way home from work, even though we're both in the car together. Right? It never happens when we're even necessarily, I don't know, running late to a simcha or an affair or whatever. It always happens when we're in the car together. So let's work through the morning routine. And yet, when it comes to gridlock or an unsolvable problem, no matter how many times you talk about it, there doesn't seem to be any solution that ever presents itself. No matter how hard we try, even perhaps very, very calmly, number one. Number two is that the issue can't be addressed with humor, empathy, or affection. It doesn't work. So that in the midst of the conversation, where husband or wife is bold enough to do something like, or like, you stink, I'm so mad at you, and just kind of make light of the whole thing and be a little bit silly, that just never takes. It just never seems to be working. It may be that the unsolvable problem is that the other spouse is incapable of receiving that repair attempt. Just no matter what, just cannot just refuses to ever give in, refuses to ever allow the conversation to be veered towards sort of a happier and more mellow and more lighthearted sort of place. But none of those repair attempts ever seem to work. It's just, it's immovable. So number three is that the issue is becoming increasingly polarizing, meaning that it's having impact elsewhere also. That this is something that just, that we fear, that we view ourselves as having a lack of togetherness because this problem is still there, it's still constant, it's still present, we haven't been able to address it no matter what we've done, and we fear ourselves basically being torn apart by this issue, by this problem. We can't seem to address it, we can't seem to find any way around it. Finally, four. This is awesome. This is awesome. So number four, so compromise seems impossible because it would mean selling out. So I mentioned this before, that it's so fundamental to who I am. It is so part of my core system of values, of what I believe in. What you're asking me to forfeit, what you're asking me to give up on, what you're asking me to change, what you're asking me to do differently, is not as simple as taking on an extra errand, is not as simple as just spending a little bit more time here or there, but rather that I feel fundamentally you're asking me to sell out. You're asking me to be something other than I am. You're asking me to like violate what I actually stand for as a human being. Then you know you're in a very, very difficult, very tight sort of spot. It's likely an unsolvable problem. Even so, even if that's the case, it doesn't mean that there's no way to manage it. It's just that there's no way to solve it. It's always going to be there. It's always going to be looming. It just means that you have to sort of learn to live with it. This is really, this is a rather unfortunate example, and it's very, I don't know, it's almost very, very harsh, but I think it spells out what I'm talking about in a way that I can think of no better. So I once, I forget even the nature of the shiur, but I remember it was, the speaker was discussing having lost a child, and was saying that effectively losing a child was really like losing a limb. It's like losing a limb. That the rest of your life is not about getting over it, it's about accommodating it. It's about finding other ways to basically doing everything else. You're always mindful of it, it's always present, it never completely heals, it never grows back, it never really gets better. You just spend the rest of your life finding ways around it. Doesn't mean that you can ever be happy again. And it doesn't mean that you can never have fun again. It doesn't mean that you'll never have any meaning or any fulfillment after that takes place. It just means that it is just always there. So in a far less serious, a far less morbid capacity, but just to give something of a mashal, these are going to be the kinds of things that are just always there. We never find ways around them. They're going to loom pretty large. They're going to come up again and again and again. They're going to be the subject of conversation. They're going to be the subject of debate and argument and annoyance, but it doesn't mean that there aren't ways that we can still accommodate and manage and find ways around. He gives a great story, and I think this is so, it's a parallel, but I think it's still very, very important, especially for us. So Gottman talks about the importance of identifying hidden dreams, that one of the most critical ways that we can deal, that we can manage with unsolvable problems is recognizing they don't come from nowhere. I'm not married to somebody who's just so completely selfish. This is where all the previous principles become very important. Having that sense of fondness and that sense of admiration and that sense of mutual respect, and that I appreciate my spouse, I look up to my spouse is my role model even in certain capacities. So that if I really believe that, then I don't just believe, oh, you have this issue, there's this unsolvable problem, I keep seeing it again and again and again, that is like a scar against your entire personality. I fundamentally don't appreciate you or don't respect you as much as I, as maybe some other spouses do towards their spouses. So Gottman says you have to be something of a detective in identifying hidden dreams. What is it about what my spouse really wants in life that might actually really be motivating that? It doesn't mean that it'll ever solve this problem. It might still be on opposite ends of the table as they are, But just recognizing that that's where it's coming from can go a long way in appreciating and respecting my spouse as a person. So he tells the following story about an agnostic and a Catholic. Apparently when they got married, religion wasn't important enough to either one of them to really be an important conversation. Remember when I was dating, there were the questions that we called like the third date questions. Right, that was it. First two dates, you know, chemistry, just see if you enjoy having a good time and like hanging out with one another. And then he kind of wanted to know, like, third date, like, where you're heading, what's life about, like, what do you want your home to look like? Third date questions. This was not a third date question. It wasn't a fourth date question. I get it. I understand. You don't believe in God and you believe in God. But apparently it wasn't important enough to either one of them to really make a big deal of it until they had a child. Say a baby boy comes along. And the agnostic husband, finds out that his Catholic wife was surreptitiously having conversations with her parents, planning a baptism. And he flipped his lid and, I don't know, gave her a whole, like, mustard from, I don't know. Anyway, he was livid, absolutely livid over this. That this is backwards and it's crazy and it's nonsense and you can believe in whatever you want, but how dare you drag my children into this, and absolutely not, and nothing, you know. And I think ultimately they came to Gottman, and he had them sort of speak about their backgrounds and what it was all about. And apparently, the wife was speaking to her parents now, but when she was growing up, it was a terrible divorce, and she didn't get along with either one of her parents, and her parents didn't get along with one another at all, and she found solace and comfort in the church. And she went to Sunday school, and she went to classes, and she found tremendous meaning and tremendous comfort in prayer. And because she never got that degree of comfort from her parents, she wanted to ensure that her son would have this very meaningful part of her life that was then passed on to her. And it never came up in dating, because whatever it was, she basically had moved on from it. But the idea that as a young child, you'll know that like God is there to protect you, and the church is there to protect you, and prayer and all that, really wanted him to have it. Meanwhile, her husband had a rock-solid family life. Loved his parents, got along with them really, really great. Everything was beautiful. And his parents didn't believe in God. Didn't believe in God. And, at least from his very, narrow, limited, like, what's in it for me perspective, didn't need God. What do I need God for? How are my parents? My parents protect me. My parents take care of me. And there's this sense that basically the church is going to come in and drive a wedge between parents and child. Meaning that if my child is baptized and if my child has religion in his life, so then he doesn't need his parents as much. And then there's going to be another force in his life that's basically serving us in a dynamic kind of capacity, telling him what to do and what not to do, and I refuse to allow it. Just having had that conversation and recognizing where it was coming from gave them the ability to be respectful of one another, to recognize where they were coming from. This is not a conversation really about religion and the purpose of religion, that it's there to make us feel like warm and fuzzy and safe and protected. But the reality of this couple, I think, speaks volumes. That being willing to have those conversations sometimes can go a long way in just respect, admiration, appreciation for why it is that you feel so strongly in this way. I get that you're not just speeding because you're totally reckless, totally irresponsible, don't care about me, don't care about your life or my life or our children's life. It's that for whatever reason you feel the need to seek independence in this capacity. This is always how your father expressed his independence, was by driving quickly. And you have these wonderful memories of, you know, him buckling on and saying, check it out, son, I'm going to pop a wheelie now, like right in the middle of the freeway. It's going to be great. Or wherever it is that it comes from. So I think there is a very, very important element or a very, very important dimension when it comes to, certainly when it comes to us, religion can often be something that we're talking about and we're having conversations about at home. And it doesn't mean, it is, put it this way, not just that it doesn't mean that husband and wife will always be in the same place, it is impossible. It's impossible. It's impossible for any two people to be in the exact same space religiously, about all the exact same things. The midos and character development and connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in that capacity might be very important to one, and tefillah might be very important to the other, and learning might be important to one, and chesed might be important to the other, and it could just be varying degrees of belief in the first place. But understanding and hearing and acknowledging where they're actually coming from can go a very, very long way in being able to create that mutual respect that needs to be there in order for the marriage to be able to succeed. It happens with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael, at least according to Rashi and other Mefarshim. Spoken about this before. But that with the Eagle and the Mishkan, so the order of Parshas Kisisa runs as follows. In Perek Lam, final pasuk of Perek Lamed Alfi, Tena Moshe Kechalasol Daberito Bahar Sinai Shnei Luchos Aidus Luchos Evin Ksuvim Be'etzba Elokim. So Kadosh Baruch Hu gives all the gives the Luchos Kol HaTorah Kula. It's all happening up on Har Sinai, and then the immediate next pasuk, the beginning of the very next Perek, Vayar Ha'am Kivoshesh Moshe Laredes Min Ha'ar, that the nation sees that Moshe delayed in coming down the mountain. What do? They freak. And they make an egel. Rashi says, "Ein muktamu ma'ocher b'torah." Not everybody agrees with this, but Rashi says, "Ein muktamu ma'ocher b'torah." There's no chronological order to the Torah. The idea that we first talk about Moshe being up on Har Sinai, receiving all the mitzvos, delivering all the mitzvos, thereafter to Klal Yisrael, and then after we talk about the egel hazav, it's out of order. Egel hazav came first, and then at least a portion of the mitzvos were only received thereafter. Specifically, Maase Ha'egel Kodem Letzivui Melechas HaMishkan Yomim Rabim Haya. The Mishkan happened many days before Moshe Rabbeinu was given the commandment to build the Mishkan. So consider the following. If that was the order, and that needed to be the order necessarily, why is Rashi throwing in this Ein Mukta Mamochar B'Torah here? Because one, by definition, or one becomes the catalyst for the other, per se. It is because of the Egel Hazav that were given the laws of the Mishkan. A nation that shows itself incapable of just completely imagining an invisible God and being able to connect without a finite physical intermediary, I'm connected to Hashem, I can daven to Hashem, I don't need gold, I don't need silver, I don't need anything tactile, I can just connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, maybe doesn't need a Mishkan. But a nation that chose itself that we're incapable of that, that I can't feel like I'm connecting to Hashem without having something to actually put my fingers on. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, listen, you can't have an Egel, that's called a Avodah Zarah. You can have a Mishkan. You can have a temple. You can have a physical finite space with gold, with silver, with tapestries, with textiles, with copper and with wood, where you're going to serve me. What is the greatest chait of all time? What's a total offense, a total affront to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's dignity and the violates the trust of their relationship? What does Hashem come back with? He says, I understand where you're coming from and I'll accommodate it. I get it. I appreciate it. I respect it. You're wrong. You're wrong. It's not acceptable. You have to take responsibility for your actions. This was not okay, but I will come to understand and appreciate where you were coming from, and I'm going to do what I can in order to accommodate, in order to make space, in order to make room, so that it doesn't happen again, so that the relationship can not only be pieced back together, but be even better than it originally was. But on the topic of piecing things back together, I spoke about this yesterday, I just want to bring it up quickly, that the Ramban, in discussing the symbolism of the Kli Cheres, the earthenware vessel that the Mesota was actually held in, says that the reason for the Kli Cheres, the Ramban, the Kli Cheres, Simen Shetishaber Kekli Yotzer, that she is shattered, she is destroyed like a Kli Yotzer, like a piece of pottery that's been shattered on the floor. So, spoke about this yesterday, but the point is as follows, that there are two possible outcomes of the Sota. One is that she's guilty, and granted, completely destroyed, shattered, marriage is over, relationship's over, she explodes, it's very messy, terrible. The other possibility is that she's innocent. She goes back home. So if she goes back home, then how does this symbol make sense? The reason why the symbol makes sense is that it's broken anyway. Is that it's a new reality. That the life that they used to have and the marriage that they used to have is not the same marriage that they're able to have tomorrow. Because something has changed. The dynamic has changed. There's been this discovery of a breach of trust. Of seeking something outside of the marriage that was supposed to be found within. And I think this is true of all of these kinds of unsolvable problems. I have hit upon something, a dimension of my spouse's personality, of their core, their value system, who they are, what they're about. My marriage can't be the same tomorrow, the same way that it was yesterday. Because I can't just gloss it over, and I can't pretend that it doesn't exist. To really appreciate, to know, to understand, and to bond with my spouse is to be aware of this new reality, of this dimension of their personality that I've discovered that's not going anywhere. If I just gloss over it, pretend like it's not there, it's going to bubble up from beneath the surface again and again and again and be a perpetual problem. It needs to be, if not solved, it needs to be grappled with. I mentioned the idea of kintsugi, which is this Japanese art of, this is what it looks like, by the way. So this Japanese art where you don't just take the pottery and when the pottery shatters, you just throw it out, but that you make a point of piecing it back together in a way not so that the cracks are hidden, but so that the cracks are highlighted. There's a sense that every time you overcome one of these fissures and one of these breaks, one of these shards is put back into position within the final piece of pottery, that's a celebration. That's a celebration. I think that needs to be the way that we look at some of these things. These are small little trophies that we carry around in our back pockets, that I recognize that there's something about my spouse that was not my cup of tea, but we found a way to work through it, to process it, to move beyond it, and we have a different, it's not the same marriage. We have a different marriage now than we did before we realized that that was there, but it could be even more beautiful and even more special and something that bears even greater celebration than when we thought that everything was just wine and roses because we really didn't know any better. Finally, I may have mentioned this, I'm not sure, but the final two, the degrees of the relationship that we speak about there in Shevet Brachos are a hierarchy. Ava, Achva, right, going in order, Shalom and Reus. The penultimate mida that we can have in a relationship or in our marriage is Shalom, which is beautiful. It's really blissful. Everyone is just, it's like coexistence. Right? We're able to sit next to one another and we're able to live a life together. But to some degree, we can almost be like ships passing in the night. Right, that we're living parallel lives, but we're not necessarily really, really, really dealing and really connecting, really bonding on everything that actually makes us us. Reus is the next phase. It's beyond coexistence, and it's hopefully the point that we're wrapping our heads around and seeing the beauty in. It's the point at which we say that which bothered me, but I was willing to live with, I actually recognize as being a critical component of my marriage, even as it continues to bother me. But the idea that I've appreciated where it comes from, that I understand it, that I get it, that this has opened up a new vista and a new area into my spouse's personality that I now understand better than I ever did. And again, that's something worth highlighting. It's not something that we want to hide. I mean, hide from the rest of the world, but it's something that within our own relationship, we want to highlight, we want to be proud of, we want to celebrate the fact that even though this puts us at odds, the idea that we're still going strong and that we're able to continue to sort of go down life's path together is far beyond Shalom. It's in a whole new state of marriage and one that is very, very much worth celebrating. Let's talk about the final principle. Principle 7. This one is really fun. I think this is the most fun principle. I also think it's the least important, frankly. Probably the least likely and the least critical. Create shared meaning. And here is basically the description that Gottman has for what this principle is meant to sort of attack. The problem is that things can be pleasant, but they can be hollow. So he says that he has been with couples in which, like, everything is fine. Everything is fine. There could be no more insulting word, no more insulting description of a marriage than that it's fine. We shouldn't be asking each other these questions, but can you imagine if somebody were, theoretically, to ask you, like, how's your marriage? And the best that we could muster is, fine. That's not good enough. Hopefully we understand that that's not good enough. That's why we're here. That's not okay. That's not acceptable. But it could be fine. It could be fine. We don't fight. We don't argue. We're not like giving each other the silent treatment either. It's not that we don't talk. But we don't fight. I don't know, whatever. It's, you know, I have my life and she has hers and we have, you know, some degree of, you know, mutual bond. We live in the same house. We, you know, we're in the same room. But it's just hollow. It's just hollow. That sometimes I can feel like I have my own life, but effectively I become more defined by my independence, even within the context of marriage, than that I become defined by the marriage itself. So what do you do about that? So meaning, how do you, like, there's nothing else to work on. There are no problems. Sometimes like a real problem, a real issue. Gridlock is great. You can work it out, and then you feel closer to one another afterwards. What if that's just not happening? So here are some interesting kinds of approaches. This is the way that I thought of, I kind of processed everything that Gottman talks about in this last principle as being something like school pride. I'll tell you, I actually think, I want to give a shout out to somebody that I don't think I've ever met before. I think, and maybe my, more or less my contemporaries in the room can back me up on this. When I was in school, there was no such thing as school pride. I didn't feel that I had any school pride, bichlal. And again, maybe this is only like, this is specifically in like the modern Orthodox world, but I didn't feel it. I didn't have really the sense that my friends felt it. I didn't think that, like, when I was in, maybe I shouldn't record when, wherever it was, I didn't feel like, yeah, I'm in this school is like the greatest. Nor did I have the sense that most of my other friends in other schools felt that way. I think that DRS invented school pride. I firmly believe it, and I think it's a tremendous testament to Rabbi Kamenetsky. I think that he created that sense that, like, I'm proud to be in DRS. And, like, it means something to me. These are my rebbeim, the greatest rebbeim. When I was in Mevaseret, I totally had it. Totally had it. I would go around, like, blabbing to everybody who would listen, and it was like, just essentially, like, yeah, we obviously have the best rebbeim in Eretz Yisrael. Like, clearly. Like, because, you know, like you know, Shas, and, like, represents, like, the biggest lamed in the world, and then, like, we have, you know, like the Hezda Rebbe and the Hasidic Rebbe. Like, we have, the greatest rebbeim, like, in Eretz Yisrael. And then, you get a little bit older, and, like, you see a little bit more, like, oh, like, every yeshiva has the greatest rebbeim in Eretz Yisrael. They're always, like, huge, tell me the chachamim, and their characters, and their dynamic, and fine. But at any rate, I think that is a very, very important point. That I have a sense of belonging and pride, that, like, this is what my marriage stands for. I belong in this home. I belong in this marriage. I belong in this family. And it doesn't mean, it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. It doesn't have to be that I am better than all of the other marriages, or that my family is better than all the other families. That's irrelevant. But just when I walk inside my home, I feel like, yeah, this is what we stand for. This is where I'm meant to be. This is where I have my purpose. It's a sense of belonging. It's like a sense almost of school pride in your own home. So how do you get there? I think these are all, like, really fun. So strategy one, he talks about rituals of connection. We are blessed with rituals all around the year that just hopefully, now look, these can be times of great stress in the home also. And I recognize that. I'm not blind to that. But we have opportunity and after and opportunity and opportunity. So there's Shabbos and Yom Tovim that are huge. There's a sense that, oh, we're doing Shabbos together. We sit around the same Shabbos table together. We have a sense of what Yom Tov means in our house and how we're preparing and that we're doing it together and that we're involved together. And I know that everybody else around me is doing the exact same thing. It doesn't even mean that it's unique. It doesn't even mean that we're the only ones who do Shavuos right. Yeah, like, we do Pesach, but our Seder is better than everybody else's Seder. It's irrelevant, but it's my Seder. It's our Seder. Like, we have a way of doing our Seder, and maybe everybody else is even doing the same thing, but it's a sense of belonging. This is what my Shabbos table looks like. This is what my Yom Tov table looks like. Birthday parties, family outings and vacations. Like I said, yeah, remember when we did that all together and we went there? Maybe everybody else also went to the Grand Canyon. Who cares? We went to the Grand Canyon. We had that family vacation. We went to the Catskills. We went to D.C., time alone. This is, it's a cliche and everybody talks about it. I mentioned at the very, very beginning that if you're talking about a date night, if you're talking about getaways, it can be smothering the fire. It could be smothering those embers. You could very, very quickly, if you don't have these other more fundamental and more critical principles in place, you could spend thousands of dollars going to Hawaii just to find out that you really, really can't stand being in the same room as one another and have absolutely nothing to talk about. But if you have plenty to talk about, and you can converse, and things are pleasant, it can be a tremendous, tremendous shot in the arm in giving you a sense of, like, belonging, that we belong together, we're doing something together, we have a shared life, we have shared experiences. Tremendous. By the way, it doesn't have to be expensive. It doesn't have to be expensive, because that is often the immediate pushback. It can be a walk around the neighborhood. It could be a getaway for cheap. I can give you some insights on amassing credit card points. If anybody wants to know how to make going to Eretz Yisrael less expensive than going to Delaware, you can speak to my wife. But there are ways of doing these kinds of things that don't have to be, that can be a matter of it being time and being special and being away from your normal environment and have an opportunity to interact in a way that just that you just can't get at home to the same degree. Home is critical. If you don't have that, this is a total waste of time. But once you have one, it could be a tremendous boon. Strategy 2, support each other's roles. I think this is a beautiful piyut, not just it's very stirring because we love like the melody and it's exciting, it's also the indication that davening's about to be over, so we get very excited. But Kianu Amecha, Kianu Amecha V'yata. What's so beautiful about this to me is that what it says is that on the one hand we spend all of the Yom Nara'im talking about how we're such a bunch of nevachs, that without a Kaddish Baruch Hu, we're totally lost and we have nothing. I think what's so beautiful about this piyut is that it also frames things in the exact opposite, which ups the level of responsibility, right? Mark, we were talking about this at the beginning of the Navi Shir, that also without us, Hashem has nothing. And that our roles are very clearly defined. We need Hashem to be Hashem, otherwise we're lost. Hashem needs us to be us, otherwise he's got nothing. You know why? Because if Anu Vanecha Vata Avinu, so if we're not his children, he's not a father. And if we don't have a father, then we're not children. And Anu Tzanecha Va'ata Ro'enu, so we're your flock and you're our shepherd, but if we're not your flock, you're not a shepherd anymore. And if you're not a shepherd, then we're not your flock. There's a symbiotic relationship that exists between us because it is clear that we know what we're supposed to do and HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows what he's supposed to do. I need Hashem to be Hashem and Hashem needs us to really be us. And it's true in marriage and it's true in our relationship, and part of having that sense of belonging is it being known what role it is that I'm supposed to serve in this family. This is really a sidebar. This is not to say, by the way, that the most... Well, let me put it this way. It is absolutely the case that the rigidity of gender roles in marriage and in family life is in the most Haredi of circles, or the most Amish of circles, I would assume, is not what it was 100 years ago. It's just not. It's just different. If my grandfather ever changed a diaper in his life, his father certainly did, without question. If my grandfather ever washed a dish in his life, then his father certainly didn't. If my grandfather ever cooked a meal in his life, then his grandfather certainly didn't. And I don't think that's something that we need to shy away from. It's changed. But I will say this: the less rigid those roles are, or the less clearly defined those roles are, the more difficult it is to have a clear sense of belonging. When it is very clear that there are certain things that a husband relies upon his wife to do, and there are certain things that it is clear that a wife relies upon her husband to do, or throw kids into the mix, that there are certain things that we need from mommy, and there are certain things that we need from daddy, it becomes... where there is a greater opportunity to feel a sense of belonging, feeling like I really know my place, have this place, I'm firmly entrenched in this life, in this marriage, in this household, in this home, and it can't be taken away, and I wouldn't want it taken away. And I feel like this is absolutely where I belong, because I feel so much is riding upon me. When that's unclear, and it's worth having the conversation, and it's worth talking about. What do you think is my role? What do you think is your role? What do you think that each one of us brings to the table? And walking around with that sense gives a tremendous sense of pride in what we bring into our marriages and what we bring into our homes. Strategy 3, shared goals. Having a sense of mission. And this means that we have to be willing to discuss life's goals, not just like what are we doing tomorrow, and not just what are we doing with the kids, and not just like where are we going, and what are we doing, and what are the errands, and what needs to be shopped for, and what are we eating on Shabbos, but like discussing life's goals and having a sense of sharing an actual vision with one another. This is what we want of our home. This is what we want to accomplish as a family. This is what we want to accomplish as a couple. Having a family mission statement, a spousal mission statement. This is what we want to be able to do. But what it all boils down to is that we want to be able to develop an ambition beyond just what I myself want to achieve. It's not that I have certain goals that I want to achieve, and the game and the trick, I always thought about sleep as being like a game or a trick. It's like this like absurd like rule that everybody just has to abide by. Right, like I want to be able to do all these things over the course of my life, and she's like, you also have to sleep. I don't know whatever it is. I don't know. You have to sleep 7 hours, 2 hours. I don't know, whatever. You have to sleep 3 hours, and not so fast. You also have to go to sleep. Ha ha! Like what kind of maniacal sort of like? Why? Just let us keep running, and I don't know. Seems odd. So I have my ambition, but then there are parameters. Marriage and family life can't just be that I have my goals, but I just need to make sure that like I take care of all my responsibilities, and all my responsibilities to everybody else are discharged, and then I can go about whatever it is that I want to do, whatever I want to do professionally, whatever promotion I want, whatever title I want to achieve, however many blot I want to do, however much I want to succeed, and whatever I want to make a CM on, and et cetera, et cetera. My ambition needs to encompass my family life, what I want to be as a husband, as a wife, what I want to achieve together as a husband and wife, what I want to be able to achieve as a family, to be able to incorporate more of one another into what our life's ambitions and what our life's missions actually are in the first place. Finally, I think, strategy four. I think this is really fun. I don't know, I never really thought about it, but I think Gottman makes a very good point. He talks about shared values and symbols. So really almost the way he speaks about it is symbols of shared values, really. Having symbols of shared values. So what are examples? Like souvenirs and mementos. Things around the house that give me the sense that, like, oh, this is my home. I remember I don't remember which direction this trick cuts in, but that when you're staging a home to sell, I forget. You either want to have, you want to not have personal stuff, right? It's supposed to be pirate. It's like a blank canvas, right? You want to dafka not have any indication. So it's like you walk into a home and it's like pirate. There's no sense that any specific family lives here. It's very well kept and it's very pretty and it's very beautiful. But the idea that there are reminders all around me in my life that this is where I belong, that this is my life, that this is sort of the headquarters of my life. And again, it's not just like I have to pay my dues so that I can go about doing all the rest of my stuff, but that there are reminders everywhere of things that we've done, of little tchotchkes that we picked up along the way, family pictures, scrapbooks. Gottman talks about family pictures of his ancestors that are very, very important to him and important to his entire family, saying that this is what we stand for. We're sort of a link in the chain. We're the next generation, and what are the things that I want to take from my great-grandparents and make sure that I pass down to my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. And a sense of belonging, a sense of really being in it. Gifts and trinkets, things, oh, I remember you bought this for me on my, you know, on our fifth anniversary when we went to that place and the car broke down and we were in the gas station, so you got me this, you know, whistle because you were sick of hearing the sound of my voice. He said, just blow this in, whatever. Yeah. But then, like, I remember, I just tucked away in a drawer someplace. But all around are these little objects that just remind us of the depth of the relationship that we have to have, or that we have had. Intangibles, he talks about, like aromas, sounds. This is a reflection from my own parents' home. Like, I can't smell, like, walnuts and apples without thinking about Pesach. And I just have, like, memory, or even, like, kerosene. Because my father used to be the one to bring it for beer chametz. Just weird, random kinds of things and sounds that become meaningful and that we're just surrounded by and that have certain triggers in our own minds that we're part of a family, we're part of a system, and we're part of a marriage that really defines us and gives us a sense of belonging. As I think is really important, Sfarim and Gedolim pictures. This is where we're headed. These are our role models. If they are. I'm not pushing my religion on anyone, but you know that, like, you can tell a lot about people by the libraries that they keep. I would venture that you know, if there are pictures up in people's homes throughout the community, I mean, okay, 75% of the community has a picture of Tanakh that we know, but the other 25, they're like, so there's some variability. I think there's a lot to be said for that. That there are certain sarim that like, no, this is my key. This is what I, and I want my kids to know that, and I want my spouse to know that, and collectively that we have a certain derech, the people that we look up to, the people who are particular role models. Family heirlooms, like I mentioned, things that have been passed down. I have these little tchotchkes from my grandmother's house, and it just gives a sense of this is my spot, this is my headquarters, this is where I really, really belong. Which, however, brings us to the end, and I'm not going to, again, be so foolish as to, you know, ask if anybody has any questions, but I will say that if, you know, it, for whatever it's worth, I'm happy to be, you know, a listening ear and a helping hand in any questions and any conversations that anybody's willing to have. Just a tremendous yashar koach and really a personal thank you. I have greatly, greatly enjoyed giving these classes and really researching and thinking over this material probably than any other series or any other classes that I've given maybe ever. So thank you for being a very willing and participatory audience, and just continued hatzlacha. I think if we've spoken about any overarching theme, is that this is something that requires constant upkeep and constant chizuk, constant meditation and constant revisiting. So, Batzlach, it's the absolute single most important relationship that any of us have in our lives, and Hatzlach on making the most of it. Shkach to everyone.